Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not that the bottom of the housing market is necessarily upon us. It's just that maybe, just maybe, now we know where it is. The housing story today is that it's getting bad more slowly. Think about that for a second. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 23rd of February today. You've got your used home sales, you got your new home sales, but if you really want to get a sense of the American housing market, Case-Shiller is the index for you. It tracks the rise and fall of home prices in 20 big metro areas across the country. The December version came out this morning, and the trend lines seem to go every which way depending on how you slice things. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to walk us through it.
When you look at the numbers year over year, home prices are down about 3%. Not great, but just a year ago, prices were down 20%. And every month, prices are inching up, says David Blitzer of Standard & Poor's.
We're settling into steady, modest gains.
Blitzer says buyers and sellers are starting to believe the price slide is over and adjusting their behavior accordingly.
When prices were plunging, the buyers were looking around, not wanting to smile too much, and saying, you know, if I wait a couple of months, it may be cheaper. I'm not in a big rush. Slowly but surely, I think the buyers are beginning to say, maybe I got to take this deal.
This new market psychology is still fragile. Housing economist Patrick Newport at IHS Global Insight warns there are several factors that could knock prices back again, like the expiration of a tax credit for first-time homebuyers and a fresh wave of foreclosures.
Right now, the number of homes that are vacant and for sale is at a record high. When you have too much supply, prices tend to drop. So I think going forward, prices are much more likely to drop than go up.
The Case-Shiller report shows home prices have kept falling by double digits in Las Vegas, Detroit, and Tampa, but they're steadily rising now in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Dallas, Denver, and Washington, D.C. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so if the takeaway from today's Case-Shiller index was mostly positive, another report wasn't quite so rosy. The Conference Board said its Consumer Confidence Index fell almost 11 points in February to the lowest number since last April. That is the first drop in that index in 3 months, and it suggests consumers aren't quite so sure about this economic recovery thing. But Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains that consumers, and this number, can be oh so fickle.
The question is, why were consumers so nervous last month? Ted Schmidt is an economics professor at Buffalo State College. He says the answer is simple. No jobs.
It's a combination of it's going to be a very slow, long recovery and just the disappointing job market, and people are getting disenchanted and certainly frustrated.
That seems reasonable enough, except that until now, the consumer confidence numbers have been going up, even though the jobs picture has been pretty sorry for a while. Stuart Hoffman is chief economist at PNC Financial Services Group. He says the number only counts when you have several months of data to work with.
I don't pay too much attention to monthly movements in consumer confidence. Frankly, the sentiment of consumers is more fickle than their actual behavior.
He guesses higher gas prices might have had something to do with this month's drop, but he says it could have been anything. Scott Hoyt follows consumer economics at moodyseconomy.com. He says even the weather can throw it off.
When we have major snowstorms or blizzards that cover significant parts of the country, the Conference Board index tends to fall hard and temporarily.
He says he can't explain why. Just keep your fingers crossed for a quick end to the cold. Hoyt says consumer confidence doesn't respond to other kinds of weather, not even hurricanes. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
I don't know that James Lentz did himself any favors on Capitol Hill today. Mr. Lentz is the president of Toyota USA, and he spent his Tuesday at the witness table in front of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, at one point saying he's not sure all of Toyota's recalls will, quote, totally solve the problem its cars are having. But while that item makes its way through the news cycle, let me ask you this. Have you noticed any similarities between the financial crisis and Toyota's current problems? In both cases, we've been told that government regulators didn't fully understand the systems and industries they were supposed to be regulating. How come? That's where we call our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
In the words of that great philosopher Stevie Wonder, when you believe in things that you don't understand, then you suffer. When Mary Shapiro led the self-regulatory arm of NASDAQ a decade ago, she vowed not to accept things at face value.
This is about enabling the regulators in particular to have the tools that they need to keep up with a rapidly growing marketplace.
Today, Shapiro heads the Securities and Exchange Commission, and she's lamented that regulators didn't keep up with financial innovation, which sounds a lot like complaints lawmakers have been leveling at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Never mind that cars have gone computerized, the agency concedes it doesn't employ any electrical or software engineers. And one investigator's email revealed he didn't really understand Toyota's high-tech braking system. As Wake Forest University law professor Sid Shapiro sees it, the watchdogs, financial or automotive, ought to be pointing right back at Congress.
These agencies don't have that much money. In absolute terms, of course, they have millions of dollars, and it looks pretty big to the average person. But compared to their responsibilities, they're underfunded because Congress has been nickel and diming them.
Shapiro says the same argument that followed the financial meltdown applies to the auto regulators. The government was penny wise and pound foolish.
When we total up the amount of financial carnage this is going to cost consumers, Toyota, to say nothing of the poor people who have been injured and killed, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And a small investment to make sure that they have the top scientists and the engineers they need strikes me as a pretty good investment.
Some experts say regulators can't be expected to predict every innovation, so they say it's understandable they often find themselves playing catch-up. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Today's Toyota hearing on Capitol Hill was a tale of two stocks. Toyota's was off 2%. Ford was up 3%. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Senate is set to pass a $15 billion jobs bill this week. It's going to be mostly a payroll tax break for companies that hire people who've been unemployed. Technology workers have been doing better than most in hanging on to their jobs, but a coalition of high-tech companies and venture capital firms thinks there is more to do. Intel CEO Paul Otellini made the announcement today, a $3.5 billion fund to invest in American technology companies, and a jobs program by Intel, Google, Yahoo, and others to double the number of newly graduated engineers who get hired every year. Paul Otellini, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
$3.5 billion is a lot of money. Why do you feel the need to make this announcement now?
You know, I think that coming out of recessions, it's all about attitude and confidence. The problems have been the level of investment and availability of startup money and those kinds of things. And this makes it real clear in very specific time frame that the venture community is open for business and willing to invest in startups in this country.
One of the things you highlighted today was the need to put more college graduates to work right away, getting into this economy and getting going. How are you going to do that? I mean, other people have tried to kickstart the labor market.
Well, it's real simple. We had an idea that if the tech companies got together and would commit to essentially double their hiring of college graduates in 2010 versus 2009, that would be a big step forward. And in just a couple of weeks' time, we were able to get 17 tech companies to commit to 10,500 jobs. Which will have an annual payroll roughly of $1 billion.
Is this a sign, you think, the fact that you were able to get 17 other companies to sign on to this initiative with you, is it a sign that companies are ready to hire again?
I think so. I mean, each company may have its own motivation, but for tech companies, the latest and greatest graduates from the universities are our lifeblood. And so by, you know, making this statement, you make a pretty profound bet on the future, and you allow the colleges to be able to encourage their graduates to continue to work in these fields, knowing that there'll be jobs there.
10,000 jobs is a lot in absolute terms, but on the scale of things within the U.S. job market, it's not all that significant.
As a percent of our engineering and scientific graduates, it's a pretty large number.
You know, there's an opportunity cost when companies like yours make decisions. An American engineer is more expensive than an Indian engineer. An American manufacturing plant is more expensive than a manufacturing plant in South China. How do you rationalize those costs when you're trying to figure out the profitability of a company?
In our industry, those numbers, those examples you gave aren't exactly true. In the semiconductor industry, or you know, people that design circuits or people who work in high-end software, entry-level engineers in the United States are not that much more expensive than they are in India now, given the wage inflation we've seen in India. Secondly, in terms of manufacturing semiconductor factories and operating them, the operating costs aren't that much different. The construction costs aren't that much different. What is different is the package of incentives and grants that some countries give to put a new factory in. In terms of how you rationalize that, you look at the overall capabilities. The four factories that we're doing in the United States right now make a lot of sense given their local economics, the fact that we had a workforce for the most part in place, the fact that we had infrastructure in those sites.
Paul Otellini, the chairman and CEO of Intel. Mr. Otellini, thanks so much for your time.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
In English legal circles today, all eyes were on a London courtroom. An appeal was being heard in the libel case of Simon Singh. To the extent you might have heard something about the case, you probably figured English libel laws couldn't really make much of a difference over here. Marketplace's Rico Galliano explains that is not necessarily so.
Last night, around 300 people packed the Old Monk pub in London. Not just to drink, they came to show support for this guy.
I'm Simon Singh. I'm a science writer, and I write science books.
Simon Singh's become more than a writer, though. He's become a free speech symbol ever since the Guardian newspaper ran his article criticizing chiropractors, medical practitioners who manipulate the spine.
I was really concerned about how chiropractors often treat children for conditions that seem to have nothing to do with the spine, things like asthma and colic and ear infections.
In his article, Singh called those treatments, quote, bogus, which prompted the British Chiropractic Association to sue him for libel. Whether he wins or loses, Singh's case and others like it have sparked a popular movement to reform UK libel laws, laws which critics say have made London the libel capital of the world.
The problem with our laws is that they are very much weighted towards privacy and reputation and against free expression.
That's Padraig Reedy of the group Index on Censorship. Unlike the U.S., Reedy says Britain has no constitutional protection for freedom of speech. And he says you don't even have to be British to sue for libel there. You just need to have had your reputation besmirched in Britain.
You know, Tom Cruise or Cameron Diaz, they can sue American publications in this country. As a result, for example, you cannot view the National Enquirer website in the U.K. anymore because the National Enquirer, for example, is so conscious of this problem.
Reform groups propose several changes in the law, everything from making trials shorter and more affordable to restricting libel suits against certain types of speech. But some say many of these proposals are overreactions, which could do more harm than good. Alastair Mullis is a professor of law at England's University of East Anglia.
There is a proposal to limit damages to £10,000. That strikes me as just wholly inadequate to reflect the harm that a serious libel can cause.
But with Britons from popular comedians to Parliament MPs clamoring for reform, some change seems likely, especially in an election year. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Coming up, which bands aren't singing the blues?
I think of indie music, in a lot of ways as the most elitist and the most ignoring the recession.
But first, let's do the numbers. Concerns about the strength of the recovery gave the markets a case of the jitters today. The Dow Industrials tumbled nearly 1%, 100 points, ended at 10,282. The NASDAQ slipped 1.25%, that is 28 points, closed at 2213. The S&P 500 reversed 1.2%, 13 points, ended the day at 1,094. Financial firms led the descent. JPMorgan Chase forfeited 2.33%. Morgan Stanley shaved off 2%. Bank of America gave back 1.23% today. Retailers had a mixed day. Macy's bagged a 1% increase on a strong earnings report. Nordstrom was up about 0.2%. Discounters didn't do so well, though. Target missed the mark by more than 1%. So did JCPenney. Walmart shares marched down 0.33%. The big Intel announcement we told you about earlier, didn't do much for the company's stock or for the tech sector writ large. Intel shares fell 2.33%. Microsoft backed up 1.33% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. By Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. Just give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new residential houses for January. House committees covering consumer protection and technology get together to examine privacy and the use of location-based data collection. And he played Detective Phil Fish, one of many roles. Actor Abe Vigoda turns 89. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl with an If You Can't Beat 'em, Join 'em story. It's about healthcare. FaceTime, as they say in sales, is one of the best ways to push a product. And nobody knows that better than drug companies. They've got almost 80,000 pharmaceutical sales reps out there. That's one for every 5 doctors. And they are very good at what they do. Sales of brand-name prescription drugs in this country are worth billions of dollars a year. Thing is, states pick up a lot of that tab through programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Obviously, they're looking to hold down costs any way they can, which brings us to the join 'em part. States using drug company sales strategies to bring doctors a somewhat different message. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Kristen Nocco works for the state of Pennsylvania as an academic detailer. Her job is to visit doctors and give them a rundown of the latest independent research on which drugs and other treatments work best for different conditions. The idea is to let doctors see how that expensive brand name drug stacks up against the older, cheaper one. If, that is, Kristen can get through the door.
You're dealing with front office staff who are used to dealing with a drug rep. Hi, I'm from Lilly. Oh, hi, I'm from this oxygen company. And now I'm this person who doesn't have samples, who am I working for the government to give the doctor education? Like, it was just a hard concept to get around.
The doctor's staff is so used to hearing a sales pitch. The fact that Kristen doesn't have anything to sell makes her suspect. Many times she's been turned away. And so Kristen approaches every doctor's office, kind of like a fortress that must be scaled. 8:30 in the morning, she pulls her minivan into a doctor's parking lot. She jumps out in a blue business suit. Opening a pack of gum with one hand, she pulls an information booklet from a crate of brochures with the other and wedges a 5-pound bag of peppermints under her arm.
A bag of mints.
Mints? Is that crucial?
Well, every office, everyone wants a little mint, a little candy. I think it's important to give someone something.
Kristen has a lot of practice getting into doctors' offices because for years she worked as a sales rep for the drug company Eli Lilly. She sold Prozac and Humalid and something called Seclor, She was that drug rep you've seen cruising into the doctor's office, kibitzing with office staff, passing out freebies.
You know, here's some pens for you, or here's some sticky pads, or, you know, I got a mug that you'll love.
All that stuff that's illegal today.
Hi, Brigolante.
Now, Kristen walks into the office, armed with nothing but an information packet and mints.
Oh, sure.
She's a familiar face now. The doctor leads us right in.
A little chilly still in here, sorry.
Well, I have a thermos on today, so I was just like, you know what?
Man, it's cold.
Lisa Galante is a busy primary care doctor. Like all the doctors in this education program, she sees a lot of elderly patients, prescribes a lot of drugs. And she tells me something most doctors aren't so eager to admit.
You know, you don't have time as a doctor to verify what everybody's telling you. You just kind of smile and sign for the samples, you know? I mean, basically in a rush. And Kristen comes in and gives you data looking at all the kind of summary of the research that's out there.
The summary that Kristen presents is produced by Harvard, but you can tell someone's worked hard to make it seem not so Ivy League. The idea behind academic detailing is to present the most respected research using the snazzy marketing of the drug companies. It's glossy and colorful, with bullet points and simple charts, easy to reference for a busy doctor.
So I feel like I'm getting a non-biased information. I'm not just picking a drug because a drug rep, you know, put it in my head. I'm choosing it for the right reasons.
I mean, the industry is trying to sell a product. What we're trying to sell is clinically appropriate prescribing.
That's Kristen's boss, Tom Snedden. He runs a program for the state of Pennsylvania that helps low-income seniors pay for drugs. He's hired 11 academic detailers like Kristen, compared to Pennsylvania's 8,000 drug reps, he says.
It's a very small band of gorillas.
Small, but effective. Since the program began in 2005, the doctors who've met with academic detailers have prescribed fewer brand-name drugs and fewer drugs overall. Snedden told me the savings offset the $1.5 million a year the state spends on the program. Kristen says she's not there to sway doctors off expensive drugs. She's there to give them the information they need to make the best choice.
So now I validated what you're doing. You're not doing it bad by using a cost-effective option.
It's a strange world we live in when non-biased information needs its own sales rep. And yet 10 states now have programs like the one in Pennsylvania. A bill making its way through Congress, separate from healthcare reform, would establish these programs around the country. It's not going to reduce the marketing by drug companies, of course. It just gives a little more face time to the other side. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Retail sales of almost every stripe have slowed down in this recession. Music as much as anything. Fewer albums are selling. More people are pirating songs or listening for free. But you don't hear a lot about the recession in pop music itself. In hip-hop, yes. In country, yes, on occasion. Even movies and television shows are dealing with the economy head-on. But the top 40 has turned a blind ear, if you will. To find out why, we got David Prince on the line earlier this week. He's the news editor for Billboard.com.
Music, in a lot of ways, is particularly escapist, especially the music that makes its way to the top of the charts. And, you know, if you look at Boom Boom Power, Poker Face, or Lady Gaga, it's a just dance. You know, I mean, the messages of those songs are very much about ignoring everything else.
But recession-themed music doesn't have to be a downer, right? I mean, if you look at from last year, Empire State of Mind, Jay-Z and Alicia Keys, right? That was not a bad tune.
And I gotta say, you know, I think it was one of last year's best songs. It's an anthem, and of all the songs that even come close to addressing what people are thinking about the recession, this one, you know, it spent 5 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. Mm. It sold over 3 million downloads alone. It was, they performed it at the World Series. And the fact that it really took on the recession, but from the idea that something good can come out of it and not taking a real negative slant on it, but taking a real positive aspirational slant on it, I think is notable.
I'm going to play another one for you here. I Hate My Job by Cameron.
Hey, yo, I'm looking for a job. Ain't nobody hiring. Then I ask the boss,
Also, not a bad tune that did pretty well.
I think it came out pretty recently, so it may do better once his album comes out. If you look at the video, I mean, he's sitting there with the want ads looking for a job. You don't see that in popular music pretty much at all.
Is that because people just want pop music to be this thing that gets them out of their current troubles?
I certainly don't think they want their rap stars to be portrayed as unemployable.
Yeah. What about their country singers? We've got Shutting Down Detroit by John Rich queued up here.
'Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down, while the boss man takes his bonus pay and jets on out of town.
Now, country music is a little bit about losing your house and your dog and your car and your girl and your job and all that stuff. But it does sort of speak to what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to argue with anybody complaining about that. You know, there's these big companies, and while people are getting laid off, the management's making their bonuses. I mean, that's the most politically charged song I can think of that's done this. And whether I like the music or not is sort of irrelevant.
Oh, everybody likes a good country song. Come on.
Well, everybody likes a good country song.
What about indie music? I mean, some of the folks out there just doing their own thing.
You know, I think of indie music in a lot of ways as the most elitist and the most ignoring the recession and the economic realities, because if you have the opportunity to really pursue a music career in this day and age and do nothing else, then you probably have some expendable income.
Expendable income. So it's kids who have some money, basically.
Indie yuppies is a phrase that I think of a lot when I'm reading Pitchfork.
David Prince, he's the news editor at Billboard.com. David, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, courtesy of the New York City public school system. Officials there are rightly concerned about childhood obesity, which is why they're set to approve a new rule tomorrow covering what kinds of foods can be sold by student groups during the day to raise funds and such. Homemade goods are out. No brownies or cookies or zucchini bread, because the school says it's hard to get nutritional information for home-baked goodies. Certain flavors of Doritos, though, totally okay. Pop-Tarts, too. They've got those handy nutritional labels on the side, don't you know? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 100 points, nearly 1%. The NASDAQ fell 28 points. That's 1.25%. The S&P 500 dropped 13 points, 1.2%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins, Doug Krisner, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, somewhat later in the day, beware Greeks protesting pay cuts.
Our banks had 3 billion euros profits in 2009, in the middle of the crisis, and they ask me to reduce my salary. Never.
There you have it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.